ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just don't know when you're going to come across a hole, a pothole, or a ridge in the road where the asphalt's pushed up or anything like that. On my way into Portland from Haywood on the bike to go get it checked out at the bike shop, I hit a pothole and took a big chunk out of my brand new front tyre and got there and basically threw it in the bin and put another $500 tyre on the front.
Motorcyclists in regional South Australia and Victoria say pothole-riddled regional roads are taking a physical, mental and financial toll on riders. We'll have that story soon. And umpires are in short supply for a lot of regional sports. We'll meet the teenager on the Victoria-New South Wales border who this year joined the ranks of nationally accredited netball umpires, breaking the disability glass ceiling at the same time.
I don't know why I fell in love with it. I just did. It's just something about the game that I honestly don't know what it is, but it just sparked something in me and really took a new passion in me.
His rapport with the players and his communication on the court was fantastic. I was just gobsmacked by him, really, to start off with. Never seen a wheelchair using umpire before, ever.
I'm Alex Simon, and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, the unexpected shutdown of Australian herb and salad grower Dickie Bill has left backpackers and Pacific Australia Labour Mobility, or PALM scheme workers, scrambling for new jobs. More than 180 people were working at Dickie Bill Australia's Queensland and Victorian farms when they suddenly found themselves unemployed last week as the family-run company went into voluntary administration. Gippsland reporter Madeline Stutchbury has been following this story. Maddie, can you bring us up to speed on what's happened with this salad grower, Dickie Bill?
Certainly. So news came through late last week that employees turned up at the gates of the Mafra-based property here in Gippsland to be told that they were out of work. Now, across the two sites in Victoria and Queensland, Dickie Bill hired more than 180 people, and the news came through that the business had gone into voluntary administration, which put all 182 people immediately out of work just weeks before Christmas.
Now, it sounds like this has come as a real shock to lots of people. Who's been most affected here?
It did come as a shock, and I think there was some confusion in the community for a few days until word got around as to what had actually happened. Most of these employers are employed as either backpackers or PALM scheme workers, and they get moved between the Victoria site and the Queensland site depending on what crop is in the ground. The town of Mafra, it's an agricultural community, and even though majority of these workers aren't local as such, that backpacker economy is really important to the community. And I spoke with Adam Mayer, who is one of the owners of the Cambrai Backpackers Hotel in Mafra, and he said that he and his wife Beck had been sort of scrambling to help secure alternative roles for these backpackers and PALM scheme workers, which was a lot of energy for them to expend. And it was sort of speaking to the uncertainty that many of those employees felt at that time.
Beck's been very proactive and straight away onto it, sending emails and that over the weekend and social media posts. Out of the 12 we had out there, we've replaced six of them at the moment, with possibly another two getting work shortly. And it's not easy, you know, people say, oh, there's work everywhere or whatever, but there isn't, like, because employers are looking for a skill set, and especially if it's busy, they want to top up over Christmas, or they're shutting down for a Christmas, New Year period and having their holidays.
That's Mafra hotel owner Adam Mayer there. So, Maddie, what's the situation then for these workers now?
The last I spoke to Adam, it seemed that the majority of them had been able to be relocated. My understanding was that a number of backpackers or PALM scheme workers were being moved to, some were going to Mildura in the north of Victoria. Others were staying local and had secured work at a Longford property. I understand that there were at least 30 workers had found other works, other roles across the state. I'm not 100% sure where those roles are. It was still quite a dynamic situation last I spoke with my contacts, but it seems that it was more the sudden nature of this voluntary administration that caught people off guard, that they didn't really seem to know that it was on the cards.
As you say, a very sudden situation and 180 workers. What does this mean for those communities where the farms are located?
I think it's twofold in terms of you've got the local economic impact, but you've also got the impact on the family, the McLeod family. This is a multi-generation farming business, and the son, Ryan McLeod, had taken on the business after his father had passed away. They supplied triple washed and packed fresh salads and herbs, both domestically and internationally. They were a major supplier to Coles. So from that perspective, it's a pretty big operation to no longer be operating in Australia and in a small community of Gippsland. There's a lot of emotion as well around this. And then you've got employees and community who would reap the benefits of having such a big operation in their backyard. And you've also got the sentiment of it's weeks before Christmas. It's a horrible thing to have happen to employees and also to the business itself. From a Gippsland perspective, we've also had another large employer of the area be shut down in recent weeks. Last week, workers were made redundant at a sawmill in Yarram. About 70, 73 people there lost their jobs, but that was still quite a sudden closure as well, and many people were left out of work and with a lot of uncertainty and the prospect that they may have to actually move out of the area to secure work. So from the Gippsland perspective, it's been a pretty hard couple of weeks on the employment front.
And just finally, Maddie, is there a chance someone else might take the business on and reopen the farms?
My understanding is that the landowner, Warrakiri Asset Management, they are looking to find alternative tenants for the property. Now, they have an obligation to manage and maintain the existing crop that's in the ground and work with the administrators on the proceeds of that crop. I'm uncertain at this point in time whether there have been any clear conversations in regards to possible tenants now taking on those properties, but that's something that the landlords are looking at doing.
Madeline Stutchbury is our reporter in Gippsland. Maddie, thanks so much for bringing us up to date here on Australia Wide.
Thank you for having me.
ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. Motorcyclists across regional parts of Australia are growing frustrated about the state of the roads, putting a massive physical and mental toll on them as conditions deteriorate. And some argue there is little political will to improve roads in many regional communities. Mount Gambier reporter Samuel O'Brien investigates.
The thrill of the open road attracts many. From keen four-wheel drivers to cyclists and everything in between, there are many who wheel around in their spare time. But as road quality deteriorates in regional areas of the country, many are worried the hobbies that connect them are about to disappear. One group that's been feeling the brunt of changing conditions are motorcyclists like Luke Rawson from Haywood, Victoria.
In the last sort of 15 years or so, it's really turned to shit.
You just don't know when you're going to come across a hole, a pothole or a ridge in the road, the asphalt's pushed up or anything like that. You never look at the scenery. Just before I went away for the ride up to New South Wales, on my way into Portland from Haywood on the bike to go get it checked out at the bike shop, I hit a pothole and took a big chunk out of my brand new front tyre and got there and basically threw it in the bin and put another $500 tyre on the front.
He's not alone. Just across the border in Mount Gambier, John Brutomesso is seeing his local roads fall apart too. For John, poor road conditions have also affected his health.
You've got to have good suspension, otherwise very quickly you could damage your back or your legs or your hips or, you know, any part of your body with all that sudden jarring that's unexpected or deeper than you actually first anticipate. Personally, I've spent a fair bit of money on upgrading my suspension because I have issues with my back and my legs and I just don't want it to get any worse. So I have to upgrade my suspension to accommodate the rough roads that we embrace every time we go for a ride.
Unlike driving in a car, motorcyclists feel much more of the damage popping up on regional roads. University of Melbourne research fellow Dr. Angus McCarroll works on driver attention and fatigue research projects. He says motorcyclists take on much more of a mental load than those driving cars.
It's difficult to quantify, and I'd actually go so far as to say it's an area that's been under-researched. When you start talking about deteriorating road quality, it inherently takes away some of the cognitive resources that are available for a rider that they could otherwise be applying to monitoring what's going on around them in other senses. when we actually survey people, the biggest call was around fixing defects on the road, removing potholes, cleaning up after roadworks, those sorts of things. It is the biggest complaint that people have, and I think that's a direct reflection of the individual experience people have.
Federal Liberal member for Wannon, Dan Tehan, says he'd like to see local government road crews used to fix federal and state highways.
The best thing about that approach is those local government road crews live in the local area, and they know when they fix something, they have to do it properly because they live amongst the members of the community and have to be able to look them in the eye on the job they've done. We need to see more and more of that, because getting outside crews in, time and time again, we've seen that the job just simply isn't done properly, and there seems to be no accountability in the way that the job is done.
A spokesperson for the Federal Regional Development, Local Government and Territories Minister, Kirsty McBain, says the federal government has invested $13.6 billion in Victorian roads through its infrastructure investment program. They said it also includes a further $2 billion in regional South Australia. Mr. Rawson is unconvinced he'll actually see any real changes to the quality of the roads.
To be honest, I can't see the government's doing anything about it because we're so far away from anything that gets them votes. If you're in the city, you've got bulk numbers of votes, you're going to cater to them. They're really not going to pander to us at all.
Mount Gambier reporter Samuel O'Brien with that story. Umpires are in short supply for a lot of regional sports competitions. Now, a teenager on the Victoria New South Wales border has this year joined the ranks of nationally accredited netball umpires, breaking the disability glass ceiling to do so. Lavington's Brody Taylor is the first person in a wheelchair in Australia to earn an official netball umpiring badge. Wodonga reporter Alice Walker has the story.
It's a Monday night in Wodonga, and the sounds of squeaking shoes and bouncing netballs are echoing around the school stadium.
Contact wing defence.
18-year-old umpire Brody Taylor is in his element.
Next to the wing.
I don't know why I fell in love with it. I just did. It's just something about the game that I honestly don't know what it is, but it just sparked something in me and really took a new passion in me.
He's a regular fixture at this social competition, and he's umpired competitive matches too. Which is actually groundbreaking, because Brody is the first person in a wheelchair in Australia to earn national accreditation for netball umpiring.
Honestly, it was never something that I thought I would have wanted, and didn't think umpiring was going to be that serious. But all the great umpires around me have their badges, and I thought that is one step closer for me having a purpose in the sport.
I was so shocked. I was excited. I said to Brody, this will open a lot of doors for him. He hasn't had a lot of opportunities with jobs either. And he's watching all his peers and his siblings all go and get jobs. So with opening up the umpiring, it also gave him a leeway to earn some extra money by doing something that he loves.
Brody grew up watching his siblings go off to play sport. So he started attending netball games with his mum, Del Taylor.
He got gastro at the age of 7 months old, and the antibodies attacked the lining of his spine instead of the actual gastro bug. So it ate the myelin sheath off his spinal cord and gave him a condition which we'd never heard before called transverse myelitis. So it's basically an incomplete spinal cord now.
Soon netball had Brody hooked, and he followed his mum into coaching and umpiring. But neither of them considered he could also get an official umpiring badge until he was spotted at a school event.
He was incredible. He was keeping up with the play. He knew the rules really well. His rapport with the players and his communication on the court was fantastic. I was just gobsmacked by him, really, to start off with. Never seen a wheelchair using umpire before, ever.
Contact wing defence up at the transverse.
Amanda McLaughlin knew Brody was good enough to get his badge.
Next to the wing defence.
She's the Riverina Regional Manager for Netball New South Wales.
I think the biggest obstacle, and one that was initially a slight concern, was the movement of the chair and whether that would interrupt the players on the court. But watching Brody umpire and knowing he knew his space and his positioning, he didn't interfere with the players, so Brody proved us all wrong.
Obstruction, bunnies, goal.
Brody passed his assessment with flying colours and no adjustments to the criteria.
We talk about our angles of our bodies. So with Brody, I'm talking about his angles with his chair and his vision, why he's moving his chair and making decisions sometimes a little bit behind the players instead of what we'd normally say is level or ahead of the players. But in Brody's case, it doesn't affect his umpiring. He's still making really sound decisions with the foot he's doing out there.
Ms. McLaughlin says the teenager has changed her perspective and her colleagues too.
I've had a lot of states reach out to me asking how, what did we change? Did we change anything? What was the feedback we gave Brody? And I think it's opened up people's eyes that it is a possibility. You just got to work with the umpire and make it happen for them.
Brody didn't even realise he was smashing through the disability glass ceiling.
I honestly did not know, but when I found out, I was like, that is pretty darn cool.
He's already got his eyes on his next goal.
My plans after this is to move to Melbourne, complete a degree in international studies, majoring in politics. My biggest passion is to make this world more understanding around disabilities, where it's not a question, it's just the norm, and people don't have to ask the questions anymore. But there's always going to be netball in my heart, so that is still going to be in there, and I would still love to further my career of netball.
Wodonga reporter Alice Walker with that story. Social media has become a part of many of our lives, and that's certainly the case for many teenagers. But that will change on the 10th of December, when Australians under the age of 16 will be banned from major social media platforms. Queensland reporter Zara Margolis spoke with some recent Year 12 graduates from Spinifex State College in Mount Isa about how different school may have been if Instagram, TikTok and Snapchat hadn't been part of their teenage years.
Hi, my name is Bridie Smith and I'm 17 years old. I think it should be dropped to like 14, like 13, 14. I feel like 15, 16-year-olds are already old enough. Like 16-year-olds are old enough to drive. Why can't they be on social media?
Did you use social media for school at all?
There's on TikTok, there's like a STEM page and I like follow a bunch of people that do like maths and they just explain it so simply. And like, it's really hard to find good videos on YouTube, but like on TikTok, it's easier. And you know, like, I don't know, they just go through like past externals and stuff. And sometimes I just binge watch those to help me with studying for like new perspectives.
Hi, my name's Lachlan McConaughey and I am 18. And I guess it does make it harder for certain families to communicate with each other. My sister goes to Townsville and she won't have like Instagram or Facebook or Snapchat to talk to us anymore. She'll have to ring us or over Messenger. That'd be one of the main problems here.
If you could change social media to make it better for young people, is there anything you'd change?
It's more regulated. That's about it.
What would high school have been like for you if you didn't have social media?
A lot more disconnected, I reckon. Yeah. Disconnected with my friends because I only see them during school hours. That would probably be the main issue.
Hi, my name is Frederick Boddy. And I am 18. I think most students got a way to find around it, so I don't think that is going to be a big problem. But this generation is all about like talking to friends, and everybody's relied on technology. Back in the days, like you got to go around and knock on the person's door, like on a bike, you know. I don't think that they're going to really like it, being like lazy. I think it's a good thing that the government is doing it, because some kids are like too young, text people, and it's like a full-grown man. So like, I understand why they're doing it, for the safety of the like kids and that. But I think it's basically on the parents as well, because most of the kids had phones, technology for games and that, since they were like young, 8 or 9 or 10, you know, and growing up they just think that it's normal. I'm old enough to have a phone, I'm old enough to do this.
Hi, my name's Flynn Donnelly and I'm 17. Well, I don't think it's really going to change much, because even when we were 16 we would make fake accounts to get onto the like Facebook and that. I don't think it'll change much, but I don't mind it because I think it stops that online influence for a little bit longer. You get like, I think I went on social media in grade 7 or 8, but I think it'd be a bit better to, you get a bit more time without any external influence, just your friends and your family and your school. Say somebody's just coming into junior high school that's never been on social media, it'd be good for them because they'll get quite a few more years. They'll be able to go through all junior school and just worry about going shopping after school, and rather than, you know, all the social media influence.
How different do you think high school would have been for you if you didn't have social media?
Probably would have saved a lot of time, stopped myself from, I wouldn't have doom scrolled as much and saved a lot of time. Could have put that towards probably studying for school or something, or hanging out with my mates more rather than doom scrolling.
less doom scrolling. Sounds good for all of us. Teenagers there in Mount Isa reflecting on the social media ban, and thanks to reporter Zara Margolis for that story. To WA now. In 1967, a girl was standing barefoot on the hot sand of the Great Sandy Desert, amidst the low scrub and spinifex grass surrounded by her family. Her photograph is taken and her life changes forever. Boogara Woya and her family were removed from their traditional desert life and taken into a Kimberley mission. Now aged 70, she's never stopped wondering about that photo and never forgotten her connection to her traditional land. Erin Park has the story from far north WA.
It's wet season in the central Kimberley.
I'm driving about 300 kilometres inland from Broome, trying to get to a small community called Luma, where there's a woman with a very special, unusual life story that, as far as I know, has never been recorded before.
Within minutes of arriving, I'm directed to her house.
My name is Boogara Woya. I come from the bush. I've been coming in 1967.
Boogara grew up in the desert. The Jowling woman is one of only a handful of surviving elders in Australia who remembers life before contact with white people. Now around 70 years old, her life is one of quiet routines, walking daily to the aged care centre.
She's really bossy at times, like most of the time, so yeah. But she's good. Yeah.
I come from Great Sandy Desert. I was born in Whittading, what a home called Whittading. I've been grow up all my life in the bush.
Boogara's ancestors had lived uninterrupted for thousands of years in the vast desert plains.
We walk around everywhere. We collect everything. We should go everywhere. Water all up the water hole.
But the 1960s were a time of great change in Northern Australia. Suddenly, there were new people moving across the landscape. White people. It was 1967 when Boogara first heard the truck approaching.
Do you remember the first time you saw a white person?
Yeah, I seen him, a white person walking with shirt and trousers. And my sister Sally, what was that? He went and hid in the bush. And I told my mummy, Mummy, you look like the same.
Boogara has just told me something pretty crazy, which is that the moment that her life changed forever was actually captured on camera. Apparently, that moment in the desert when she first saw white people, there was a woman there taking photographs, and she's got an album with the originals here at her house. So we're just going to have a dig around and try to find them.
This is my mum. This is my grandmother. This is my mum.
Should we go outside and have a look?
The single photograph shows her family's first interaction with the white fella world. The missionaries and welfare officers handing them clothes and guiding them into the back of the truck. But Boogara says she used to have a whole set of photos that were taken on that life-changing day, including one showing her posing for the camera. But the photo album cannot be found. Maybe lost, maybe stolen.
I've been looking for the photos, but I couldn't find it. I don't know where he was.
I promised to try to find the photos. They're irreplaceable, showing the moment that two wildly different cultures intersected in that hot desert sand.
So I'm back in Broome, and I think I've had a breakthrough after several months of digging. There's a local historian and author who's passed me on this CD. She's had it in her possession for many years. It's got 23 images on it, and she reckons one of them is that missing photograph showing Boogara as a child.
Before long, I'm back on the road to Luma. I find Boogara in her usual spot. Hanging out with her best friend and next-door neighbour, Polly, who came out of the desert the same year.
It's been 6 months since I came and visited you. You been well?
I've been well, and I look happy.
It's time to show Boogara the photograph.
Is this the photo you were telling me about? How do you feel to see it?
This is me, Boogara. I came with the name of Boogara. I had the name because my dad called me name.
The photo was taken as the last of the desert families were moving onto cattle stations and church-run missions along the coast. some voluntarily, exhausted by drought, others rounded up reluctantly. The photographer was a nurse who was volunteering at the LaGrange Catholic Mission, where Boogara and her family were soon taken.
Oh, they've probably been through a lot of changes.
My mother.
Boogara's cousin is visiting from Perth and seeing the photos for the first time.
For her, a young girl, it would have been confusing. That picture says it all right there, leaving home, you know, and wherever this mob was taking them. It would have been sad at that moment, but it would have been scary.
Boogara went on to marry a man named Jimmy, and they had three children, two of whom have since died. Boogara visits the desert less now. She's getting frail and can no longer drive. But when she closes her eyes, she's back there.
I'm sorry for that country. I've been sorry too. Sad. I've been crying everywhere a whole while because I got the memories in that place.
They've come far, very far, a long way, and they're still here, you know, managing both worlds, I guess.
Erin Park with that story from the Kimberley, and you can watch the story on ABC TV's 7:30 website or on ABC iView. And finally, we wrap up today's show on a dance floor in southern Queensland, where one Dalby resident has taken his love for loud music and turned it into something everyone can enjoy. The local monthly Discobility events have become a safe space for people living with disability to come together, let their hair down and have a bit of a boogie. Our reporter Aisling Brennan donned her dancing shoes for this story.
There's only one rule on the wooden floorboards of the basketball court at the PCYC in Dalby, and that's to have fun.
I just love playing music.
Sean Pocock is something of a celebrity around his hometown. That's because he came up with an idea to host a disco for people who might feel like they did not have a place to be themselves in the Western Downs community.
Because I want to be a DJ because there's nothing here in Dalby for them to have fun.
Discobility is a family affair. His parents, Scott and Barb Pocock, have helped Sean with his passion. That has included lending a hand with the setup or jumping on the dance floor to make sure everyone's feeling included.
The most of them wouldn't get out to go to a pub to a disco. Mm. So the disco is a full-blown disco with good music, disco music, a full light show, just so they're not missing out. We've seen people from the first disco still coming back, getting in, having a dance, associating with their peers. We've seen big changes in a lot of them.
Tonight, people have travelled from nearby towns, including Mitchell and Chinchilla, to hit Sean's dance floor and enjoy his musical tastes. And while they're in the country, it doesn't necessarily mean he's only spinning country music.
I play everything from rock and roll, the 80s, the 90s, some country, but not lots of country.
He's got such good taste, so what he plays is, yeah, it's amazing.
Sean's mum, Barb, says the monthly event is a great outlet for so many in the community to have a catch-up with friends in a safe environment.
So many out there that don't get sort of the opportunity to go and have fun time and what have you. So and they all love music, so that's a common denominator. It doesn't matter what disability they have. They all love music.
She says the event is for everyone, including carers, to make the most of it on the dance floor, enjoying the music in their own way.
It's really good. You sort of get up and you have a dance. You know, there's a majority of them come that I've known for a long time now, and I've met some new ones. But, yeah, to be up on the floor and actually be a part of it all too, and I sort of try and encourage carers and support workers to get up on the floor because it makes it more enjoyable for those with disabilities, for their carers and supports to be up and having a boogie too. And, yeah, it's just so much fun. Everyone can let their hair down and have a good time.
Sergeant Vincent Bradley runs the PCYC youth program in Dalby and says the disco has been growing over the 10 years that it's been running.
When I see them walk in here to the disco, and the minute they walk in and they see the lights, they just, all their inhibitions go and they're on the dance floor until they're told to get off it, really. So you can see the sense of community that it brings to them. It's really nice to see.
As arguably Dalby's most famous DJ, Sean has been stopped in the street by disco patrons. But if you ask him, he doesn't spin the decks for fame.
I just love playing music. Just keep on doing this.
That's DJ Sean wrapping up that story from our reporter Aisling Brennan in Dalby, southern Queensland. And that is Australia Wide for this Wednesday. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.